91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. It's easy to joke about and commiserate about middle age. Most everyone thinks life's downhill slide has begun. Some even slide into what's termed a midlife crisis. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper. We'll visit with veteran NPR correspondent Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her new book, Life Reimagined: The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. She explores research on how our middle years are not the beginning of the end. One can be transformed, thrive, and display resilience. The book also discusses meaningful ways to escape or lessen the dementia curse. Topical Currents is up next after NPR and regional news. And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you on this Monday edition. Bonnie Berman will be returning to the program tomorrow. Well, today we focus on midlife, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. With a bit of inspiration, today's midlifers have much to look forward to, for neuroscience shows the brain's remarkable capability to adapt and perhaps reach a new pinnacle. With us now is longtime NPR correspondent and former Christian Science Monitor journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty, and we'll discuss her new book, Life Reimagined: The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. And she joins us now from NPR in Washington. Welcome to you, Barbara.
Thank you, Joseph. It's great to be here.
Something in your book that struck me right off the bat was that you say anyone who says life is boring has never been middle-aged. That seems kind of counterintuitive. So where do you get that?
It does. I mean, people think of middle age as being this kind of long period where not a lot happens. You don't have a lot of markers, right? You're not having children or getting your first job or getting married, generally.
But maybe a few more doctor's visits.
You do. You have those. And I had a few of those when I fell off my bicycle and broke my collarbone. But you have other things that are really keeping you occupied. You have heavy responsibilities at work. You have probably aging parents, and so you're dealing with that. You have children who maybe, often you have children who may be heading off to college, and so you're kind of living through that with them as well. And so I think it has been an extremely active period. I thought it would be a boring period. I thought it'd be a depressing period. But it is actually really fun and really active.
I don't know. I don't know anyone in my circle, I think, that thinks that their ages in the 50s and maybe early 60s is boring. There always seems to be something on the plate, be it adult children and,
right.
And all, as you said, parents. Can be such a heavy burden.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think the key for people in midlife is to shoulder the responsibilities that they have, because they really are kind of at the peak of their responsibilities, but also try to look beyond those responsibilities and have have some fun, develop some hobbies. That's a real secret to midlife. But also to kind of choose meaning over happiness, because midlife is a time which is very meaningful. You're investing in things. You're investing in your children. You're investing in your career. You're paying back your parents often. My mother's 94 and I go to see her almost every day. These are long-term investments that make for a meaningful life. You also want to invest in friends. You want to invest in maybe a cause that really means a lot to you. And so I think if we can kind of get beyond the idea that midlife is terrible because we don't have instant gratification, we're not going out and, going to the bar each night and, going out with friends and all of that, it's a more stable period, but it's also an extremely meaningful period. And in the long run, that's what counts.
Barbara, give us a thumbnail of how you sort of took a compass reading on your life, and it began sort of suddenly by an ER visit, age 53,
right.
And also involved some of our friends from NPR that our listeners would be familiar
that's
with.
That's right. That's right. I had, it was a September day in, and I was 53 years old, and I had just gotten a really kind of angry email about a piece that had aired from the day before. And I was trying to figure out how to kind of respond to the email when suddenly I felt these chest pains and I felt heat radiating up my back, and I grew short of breath and all of that. So what did I do? Naturally, I Googled heart attack in women, right? That's what anyone would do. And it turned out that I seemed to have some symptoms of a woman having a heart attack. And so I called my doctor, and while I was talking to him, I actually fainted. So my doctor called Scott Simon, who was one of his patients, and Scott kind of came rushing up with, called the medics, called the ambulance, came rushing up. John Itzty heard me fall. He came, he tucked a little sweater under my head so that I was comfortable. And basically, and you know, another person rode in the ambulance with me. And basically, by the time I got to the hospital, I was actually feeling pretty good. I was definitely feeling beloved, right? But I was also feeling pretty good. And I tried to argue my way out of staying in the hospital. I was telling the nurse that I felt fine and I was in good shape. I went on I spinned every morning, and I was in, you know, pretty good shape for someone who's 53. And I remember her looking at her clipboard and saying, you're 53, right? And I said, yes, as if that were a clinical condition, you know. And she said, yeah, you know, I think we're going to keep you overnight. And what happened that night is actually something pretty tragic. My dad died that night while I was stuck in the hospital. And what happened is in that moment at 5 o'clock in the morning when my husband told me that my dad had died, what happened is I realized that my brothers in my generation was probably kind of the next to go, that really there was a limited time horizon. And I thought, and here I had just had this health scare, and I thought, you know what, I really need to think about this next chapter of life. I can't go on autopilot. I need to make it count for something. And I think that happens to a lot of people in midlife. And that was the wake-up call for me.
Well, the other part of your midlife crisis, so to speak, is you also had vocal problems, which is something very serious. Yes. With a radio career.
Right, right. I did have vocal. I got a partially paralyzed vocal cord, and it was okay for a while. I just would lose my voice for days or sometimes a week or two at a time. But then in 2012, the chronic pain began, and I'd never experienced chronic pain before, and it was kind of an overwhelming, anyone who's had it knows it kind of dominates your life.
And so it's a pain in your throat?
It was a pain in my throat, yes, and it's one of these questions I kept asking myself, how can I escape my own body? Because you can't. It was just always there, and it seemed to ratchet up a lot during stressful times, mainly on deadline. And so I found that I was really trying to cope with a lot of pain and doing my job at NPR. I remember, so what I actually did is I went and I got a book contract to write about midlife, because what I realized is a lot of things were happening to me and I needed to really reassess my life. And something that someone told me, a psychiatrist told me, who helps a lot of people going through a midlife transition in their careers, he said, you know, Barb, when you may be in the wrong job or a job that isn't quite right for you anymore. And for me, I found deadline stress extremely difficult. He said, when you've been coping with a job that might be somewhat of an ill fit for you, one of two things may happen. Either you will leave your job or your body will make you leave your job. And what happened is my body said to me, Barb, you need to take a break. You need to get a book, you know, book contract, take a year's leave, see what happens when you're not under a daily deadline stress. And it turned out that was a really, really good thing to do. It's a scary thing to do, but my life changed because the pain just ratcheted down and down and down, and now I have almost zero pain.
Well, the book took more than 1 year. It took it was 2 years in the making. Tell
That's
us
right.
of the process and all the interviews you did for the book, particularly on the neuroscience side.
Oh, wow. I did more than 400 interviews. Now, not all of those were researchers. A lot of them were ordinary people. In fact, I got a lot of interviews, or a fair number of interviews, when we sent out a call out on NPR's Facebook page, which said, how's midlife treating you? And almost instantly, within a couple of hours, I got 700 emails describing what midlife midlife was like for people. So I have lots of stories of people and how they coped, but I also have a lot of scientists talking about it. So here's what I did. I tried to think, what are the most important parts of one's life at any time, but particularly in midlife? And I realized that, you know, there are certain things we think about. We don't want to lose our memories. We're all afraid of getting Alzheimer's. And, you know, we all worry when we forget our colleague's name or something. We think that we're going down the tubes. So midlife brain was one of them. Midlife marriage was another. Midlife hobbies actually turned out to be kind of a secret weapon in terms of doing midlife well. Midlife career. Resilience. What happens when bad things happen to you? Because problems tend to cluster in midlife. And so what I did is I kind of figured out the important things in life. And then I went out and I did the research and I asked people, you know, how do you deal with a midlife brain that you think, you know, you think is maybe faltering a little bit? What is a midlife brain like? And so I went out and I talked to a lot of people and, that's how I ended up writing the book.
Of your non-expert responses, were there big differences between men and women?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. And you're going to be surprised by this answer. No, there wasn't. I actually thought more women than men would respond. But in fact, there were some people, both men and women, who had what I consider to be genuine midlife crises. And that's this kind of existential angst about the aging process and that you're going to die before, you know, you can achieve your dreams. There were a few emails out of the 700 I got like that. For the most part, though, people talked about, yes, problems in midlife, but they also talked about it being a really rich and meaningful time, and actually a time when, and both men and women said this, a time when they began to reorient their ideas of success. And both men and women did this, too. It's interesting. They said, you know, I used to really think that what was important was climbing the ladder, you know, becoming CEO or, you know, becoming a pitcher for the Red Sox or whatever it might be. I used to think that was important, or having a larger house or more cars or whatever, accumulation. In midlife, what I began to realize, and the research supports this, what people talked about was valuing family and friends, relationships, and also causes or things that were important to them, like church and things like that. The people who reoriented, and I would say that's the vast majority, seem to really like midlife, like it more than, say, when they were 25. They wouldn't go back to being 25. The only difference, I will say, is that the research shows that men reach there's a U-curve of happiness where people are happy in their 20s and 30s, and then they kind of slope downhill, and in their 40s and 50s, early 50s, they seem to be less happy, and then they swoop back up the U-curve in their late 50s and 60s. And they think, the researchers believe, that's just because people have so many responsibilities, so they're not kind of giddy in the moment in their 40s and 50s. But the big differences between men and women was that men seem to reach their low point at 40, and women men seem to reach their low point at 50 and women at 40. And so that was really the only difference I saw.
It seems so common in men that you hear about, at least, that that's the time perhaps for a midlife affair, or buying the red Corvette, or getting a boat and sailing around South America or something.
That's right. And, you know, I was wondering if I would find that. But what happened is, this is kind of a cultural myth that everyone, you know, dumps their spouses and dumps their old car and gets a new car and a good new model spouse and all of that during this period. And in fact, only about 10% of people have that kind of crisis, this existential, you know, sadness and angst about aging. Really, 90% of people they do fine. You know, they have responsibilities, but they really enjoy life, and they get happier and happier as they reach their 50s and 60s. So this whole idea of midlife crisis is something of a myth. And I was actually rather, happy to find that, because I really felt like having a midlife crisis seemed like a lot of trouble.
Our guest is Barbara Bradley Haggerty, a familiar voice if you're an NPR listener. And we're talking about our book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We resume our conversation with Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. Perhaps you have a brief midlife story to tell. Or are you happier in your 50s and 60s than, say, perhaps in your 20s or 30s? Perhaps you have a particular insight that you found helpful in your midlife period. Again, the number 1-800-743-9576 or email, that's radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Barbara, the midlife marriage, to the same spouse, it can be a desert, you say, or an oasis. How does that work, and what makes it be a desert rather than the oasis rather than the dread desert?
Well, first, you know, what's interesting is there's baby boomers are really, really good at getting divorced, it turns out. They even have a name for it. Researchers even have a name for it. It's called the gray divorce revolution. So boomers divorce at twice the rate their parents did. And a quarter of all divorces are with people over 50. So, and, you know, there's some reasons. One of the major reasons is that women, for the first time, are financially independent enough to say, you know what? I'm not sure, you know, I've got another 30 years. I think I'm going to find someone else, and they can actually afford to do this.
And especially if children are out of the house.
Right, right, exactly. If the children are gone, then you often see people looking at each other. You look at the Gores. We all thought that they were great, right, doing great, and suddenly they're separated and
getting divorced. The children tend to keep marriages together.
Yes, they do tend to keep marriages together. Now, there is something, though, you know, a lot of people, researchers find that a lot of marriages are really, really, remain really passionate and wonderful marriages, as passionate in their, you know, at year 15 or 20 as they were at year one. And so what they've tried to do is look at what those people do, what successful midlife marriage partners do. And they've noticed a couple of things in doing these longitudinal studies. One, here's a really interesting thing. They find that in midlife, generally the theory is opposites attract, and then they attack, right? That people who are opposite will have a really tumultuous marriage. It turns out that during midlife, you actually want your spouse to be very different. If you're an introvert, you want him to be an extrovert, because that midlife is a time when you have to get stuff done. So you need to do not only the play dates for the kids, but you also need to do the taxes, and those kind of require different sorts of people. And so midlife marriages where people are different actually work really well. But the other thing that they found is that when researchers at Berkeley watched couples and interviewed them every 5 years over the course of 20 years, what they found is that the couples who did well and were still married at year 20 spoke in terms of we and us as opposed to I and me. And so it obviously wasn't just a matter of semantics. It wasn't a matter of grammar. It was actually that couples who do well think in terms of a team, and they approach all of life's challenges, whether it's child rearing or a job loss or aging parents or whatever it might be, they approach it as a team, and they are the other person's shelter in the storm. And those marriages do really well. There's one other thing that that they recommend, and that is to have a little bit of novelty in your marriage. And by that, I mean, do something that's a little bit different. If you often go to the movies, you know, go for a hike. Or my husband and I rented an RV and traveled down the Blue Ridge Parkway. And it was really, it was quite an experience, I got to tell you. And it was wonderful because it was so novel. It was so out of our comfort zone.
Well, Barbara, tell us the story of you taking up rather serious bicycling.
Yes, you know, I did. What happened in that is I was interviewing people. I had this sneaking suspicion that people who do well in midlife often have hobbies, and it turns out that's really true. It may be playing the flute. It may be, you know, learning Spanish. Or what it may be having, you know, competing in an athletic competition. So I ended up interviewing a man named Mike Atsit, who was a four-time cancer survivor, and he was in his early 60s when I interviewed him. And he had become a cyclist. And when I interviewed him, we did it at my house, he brought his bicycle along, and after the interview, he said, okay, let's go for a bike ride. So I brought my old clunker out, and we went on this 20-mile bike ride, and he made me ride faster than I had ever ridden in my life. And he said, okay, now, Barb, what we're going to try to do is we are going to try to get you qualified for the National Senior Games, which is a competition for people 50 and older. And, you know, at the time I kind of balked, but secretly I was really, really happy about it because I think, and I've heard about, someone told me this, and I think it's really true, midlife is kind of like a book without punctuation. There are a lot of words, but there aren't a lot of, you know, paragraphs. What this person meant by this is that, you know, when you're young, you have a lot of markers, right? You graduate from college, you get married, you may have kids, you launch a job, and then you hit midlife, and it feels like the same old every single day. And what hobbies do is they give you kind of punctuation in that book. They create paragraphs and periods and semicolons. And that's what biking did for me. In this long process of writing this book, I found that I had a little bit of a goal every single day. Could I ride a 50-mile ride? Could I beat my time on that 20-mile ride? Could I train for this particular race? And I ended up, you know, it ended up being kind of this reason for me to leap out of bed in the morning. I mean, I have a lot of reasons to leap out of bed, but it was a challenge. And in midlife, we don't have that many challenges. And I ended up qualifying for the senior games and ended up competing. And I didn't win, but I did pretty well, pretty well. And I, most of all, I made a new friend. I made a lot of new friends, and I got a new hobby, a new passion in life.
Well, what about those who've worked hard and say, you know what, I've had it here. I want to take it easy. I want to get up whenever I feel like it. When I get up, I can make a choice of watching some dumb TV or maybe play a round of golf. I want to do a little bit of traveling and see my grandkids. And that's about it. Or should they be pushing it?
Well, you know, I think there is a time to do that. If you've been working hard in your job all of your life, and you have a chance, you know, maybe after retirement or in vacations or whatever, well, after retirement, if you have a chance to take some time off, I think that's a really good idea. It's not a great long-term strategy, however, and it really isn't good for your brain. So let me tell you about one of the most interesting studies that I looked into. At Rush University Medical Center, they are following people between the ages, basically from age 60 on. And what they do is they interview people at retirement homes, healthy individuals at retirement homes, every year, and they give them cognitive tests and they give them psychological tests, and they do this every year until the person dies. And they've done now more than 1,000 autopsies. Then they do an autopsy of the brain, and they can see kind of what was going on in their brain. And here's a really interesting fact. Fully a third of the people who, upon autopsy, had Alzheimer's, the plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's, never showed a single symptom. So then the researchers go, wow, that's a lot of people. What did those people, they're called escapees, what did those people do that was different from everyone else? And they had a lot of psychological and cognitive data to look back on. And the number one thing that people did, the number one predictor of not getting the symptoms of Alzheimer's, even if you have it, was this thing called purpose in life. So people who had a reason to get up in the morning, it could be that they wanted to see their grandchildren, it could be that they were active in their community, it could be that they loved reading books and they just were reading, it could be whatever it was, people who had a purpose in life cheated the symptoms of Alzheimer's. And what that tells me is you need to keep a hobby. You need to keep your brain active. You need to keep your body active if you want to live a really good, fun, engaged, you know, later life.
We're speaking with Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Again, if you'd like to join in, that number is 1-800-743-9576, or email a little quicker, perhaps, radio@wlrn.org. And we'll take some of those calls when we come back. This is Topical Currents. Hey, And 33 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We're visiting with longtime NPR correspondent and former Christian Science Monitor journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her book, Life Reimagined. And that's the science, art, and opportunity of midlife. Again, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. Perhaps you have a brief midlife story to tell us. Are you happier in your 50s or 60s than in the 20s or 30s? And any insight you might find helpful to others. Barbara, before we take calls, how about the idea of creating a new habit of mind, which you stress in the book?
Yes, this actually comes from my mother, and it turned out to be true. She always talked about a couple things. One is your thinking is your experience. So how you think about things, whether it's a setback that you might have in your career or your health or your marriage or whatever, how you think about things actually really does affect how you experience the situation. So research has showed, for example, that people who are optimists are much, much more likely to bounce back from a trauma than people who are not. And so it really, really does matter how you think. The other thing that I've found is I came up with this idea that my editor thought was too negative, but I'm going to say it anyway, and then I'll put it in a positive way. This notion that autopilot is death. And what I mean by that is, the positive way to look at it is, engage life with verve. So, anything that you feel is important, like your marriage or your career or a hobby or a cause or whatever it is, anything that you think is important, you need to engage with. So, for example, with marriages, the reason midlife marriages break up is not because couples are fighting all the time. That happens earlier. Those couples divorce at like 7 years. The reason that midlife marriage couples divorce is because they have lost interest in each other. They no longer are investing in each other. They're no longer kind of caring about the other person's day at work, or, they just aren't investing. Those are the marriages that actually end up breaking up after about 15 years. So the idea is you really should engage with your partner. If marriage is important to you, if that person is important to you, then you should engage. And I'm not saying that, you should stay in an abusive marriage. I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is that if it's kind of a boring marriage, you can do something about that. And you can think about your marriage differently. You can think about your kids differently and engage, and you will watch it blossom. That's what the research shows. You'll watch it blossom.
Let's take a couple of listener calls, Barbara. Here comes Susan. She's in Plantation. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was very interested in the conversation today. I have had some definite changes as I've approached my 50s. In my late 40s, my husband and I adopted our granddaughter. We had had a whole different plan. We have a place in Italy where we're supposed to be spending part of the year, and lots of things changed. And I couldn't be happier about making the decision to take Natalie into our lives. There are lots of people that come up to us and say, oh, you should be admired for what you did. But I think that this is what you're supposed to do, that you're supposed to take care of your family. And it's made our lives so much richer. And giving us, you talk about purpose, it's given us purpose, for sure.
That's fabulous. And if I can say, Susan, you are doing exactly what the psychologist Eric Erickson talked about. He said the hallmark of a really healthy midlife is what he called generativity. And that's investing in the generation or two, in your case, below you. So it's not about accumulation or your own life or even, going to Italy. It's about investing downward and having that relationship, or investing outward too. It can also be to causes. But what you are doing is precisely what the researchers say makes a person happy, and that is to give of yourself. You've reached a point where you can give away, and you are giving away to Natalie in adopting her. That is a remarkable story. That's really great. Purpose in life, too. That's great.
Well, and just a footnote is Natalie has traveled with us. She's been to Italy with this. I think this was her 14th trip over the Easter holiday. So she's very well traveled. She's got a great life, and she's given us all of that and more back. And I think I can't imagine what our lives would have been like had we not done what we'd done. I think I would always have been looking over my shoulder, wondering what would have happened to that little girl.
So. Right, right. And also, I mean, I think what you're doing, you know, it's easy to become very risk averse and settled in midlife. And what you did is you kind of took a risk there. And yeah. I would bet you anything that you feel younger now with her than you might have felt, you know, in your mid-40s.
No doubt. And 20 pounds lighter, too. So she's kept us hopping. So, but yeah, no, we're healthier. Both my husband lost over 100 pounds when we got Natalie. He said, I have to be healthy. I have to be there for her. So it's made us healthier. Hmm. I think our minds are much more intact, like we're brighter people. We think we're more involved in lots of ways in the world. And I think it's just been, it was the right thing to do.
How old is Natalie now?
Natalie will be 12 in a couple of weeks. And
so almost a teenager.
Yeah, thank you very
Maybe
much
things
for bringing
will change
that up.
A little bit.
Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, so hopefully we'll be all right. She's a singer, and so she's really into theater and singing, and so we found some gifts that she now has that she can hold on to as she goes through those crazy years. So, but yeah, there's a lot of us grandparents out here, and if you don't mind me plugging, everybody's got a nonprofit these days, I guess, but I started a nonprofit back in 2009 after I had come through this incredibly horrible court battle trying to fight for her. It's called Kids Have Rights, and it's all about relative caregiver, like what we are. Kinship is another term that's thrown around a lot. What those issues are quite different than maybe being a foster parent or whatnot. There are other things that happen that need support. So I'm an advocate for grandparents and relatives that are caring for children. In my own way, I do that as well. So,
Very good, Susan.
Thank you for taking my call, and thanks for the conversation.
Okay, thanks for your call. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, what's the best part of your midlife now, today?
Oh, wow. No one has ever asked me that. It's all so much better. I have to tell you, it's all so much better. I'm so much more, I mean, I'll just say this. When I started the research, I began kind of the research around age 51 when my mom had a stroke, and I began to think, I need to think about this stuff. And I was kind of depressed about that everything was just going to go downhill from here. What I've found is that my brain is operating at its peak. And even though it feels like it's not sometimes, it actually is. I have more purpose in life. I'm taking risks. My marriage is better than ever. I have a wonderful stepdaughter who's living with us now temporarily, and that adds huge joy to our lives. And so, you know, it just goes on. I love my career. I love the risk I'm taking in my career. Gosh, if I had to choose anything, I mean, I guess I would just say that relationships have become really, really, really central. You know, when you work at a place like NPR, and it's wonderful, I had the best job in the world. But, you know, when you're kind of on deadline and you're working long hours and everything, relationships can kind of fall to the wayside a little bit, and you don't take care of them as much. And I think now I have a little bit more time and flexibility to really think about other people.
So what is your career now? What are you doing?
Well, so my career now is I'm writing books. I'm writing magazine articles. I'm doing, you know, NPR is wonderful about letting me do long-form radio for them. I did a 6-part series for NPR. So what I'm getting to do is I'm really, really, really busy, but I'm getting to focus on those things that I really think are important. Like, you know, things like talking about this book was important to me. I felt that people needed to know about the research about midlife and how really what a great period it is. So right now, you know, I'm an author and I'm a magazine writer and, you know, as often as I can be, I'm an NPR reporter.
And we'll move along to Carmen in Miramar. Hey there. Carmen, you're up.
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Carmen.
Yeah, no, I wanted to say that sometimes people think that I have finished when for marriage and everything. But so life doesn't really have opportunities.
Wait, we really have a bad connection, yeah. Carmen. Can you maybe turn the other direction or something very quickly?
Okay, maybe.
It's a little better.
Okay. So what is? Do you want to know? Hello?
I'm sorry.
Yes, I think it's important in middle life to be optimistic and to do, as always, do exercises, have good food, nutrition, and information about the routine, and keep the mind active, reading, and doing exercising, moving, going to the beach, going places, and I practice dancing, and I go to the gym, and I have any routine that you can imagine in the gym, and especially dancing is the most wonderful exercise. So middle age brings so many things, and it's not middle age only, it's a period, but I'm telling it's a period of 20 years, the best years of my life. So it's a backwards, life was backwards. I was happy in my old age than I was in the younger age.
So you're just kind of doing it all, Carmen.
That's great.
Yeah.
And, you know, Carmen, Carmen has said a couple of things that are really important. We haven't really talked about the importance of exercise, but as it turns out, exercise is kind of the silver bullet. It's an elixir, especially when it comes to the brain, because what studies have found is that people who exercise just moderately, I mean, not even dancing. Dancing's great. But
say three times a week for 30 minutes,
right,
something like
right,
that.
Right, exactly. Just walking for three times a week. Those people actually retain new brain cells that would normally die. And their hippocampus actually grows. That's a very important period. Part of the brain relative to memory and learning and things like that. And so basically what researchers have found is that moderate exercise actually turns back the memory clock. It makes you like 2 years younger than you would be normally. So if you're 64 and you're exercising three times a week, your brain will look more like it did at 62. And so exercise is really, really important. The other thing she talked about is just keeping your brain active. And one thing I would say is that there's this kind of myth that, gosh, you have to do crossword puzzles and only then will you keep your brain sharp. Actually, that's not true. If you don't like doing crossword puzzles, don't do crossword puzzles. Do something that you like but is also challenging. So it might be, you know, learning an instrument, playing the guitar, or it may be learning a new language, or it may, you know, you don't know. Whatever you kind of want to do, whatever challenge is intriguing to you, do that challenge, because if you want to do it, you'll stick with it, and that will engage your brain, and that will make you stay, you know, it'll keep your memory intact, essentially. So figure out what you want to do, make it challenging, and do it.
Even though one may have been working all their lives to be comfortable and be able to retire, though it seems to take that unless there's risk involved in something you do, that's really what keeps you young.
Yeah, it's risk and challenge. I mean, I'm not advocating that people go hand gliding or anything like that, but I am saying that people should, take a little bit of a break, but people should actually challenge their brain, or else they're going to find themselves really losing their memory. I mean, this was the old saw when men would retire at 65 and they'd sit around and play golf. They'd often die pretty soon. And so what you see is this whole generation of people who are doing what are called encore careers, where they're starting a new career that helps the social good. So they're using their expertise in accounting for a nonprofit or whatever it is. And these people are staying engaged. They're often staying in the workplace on a part-time basis. These people are keeping their brains intact, and they're having social networks, which is really important for your brain, and they are challenging themselves. And so you have this whole generation of baby boomers who are having a new lease on life because they're getting an extra 20 years of life that we didn't used to get before. You know, we died at age, 45 in the year 1900, we now live so much longer, and so we really need to use those years productively and engage.
This is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We're speaking with Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her book, Life Reimagined. If you'd like to join in, we have one more segment, 1-800-743-9576. We'll be right back. And we're back. It is today's topical occurrence, Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Barbara Bradley Haggerty, longtime journalist, author of Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. As promised, more phone calls. Cindy in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Cindy.
Hey, I love your show. Yeah, my life, I was in the corporate world over 30 years in mortgage banking, and then when everything crashed in 2010, I guess I crashed. I got laid off, and then I had medical, physical, and mental issues. Come out of the darkness, and I actually found working with the homeless right now. I do have a part-time job, but I've dedicated my life to helping feed the homeless in South Florida, and I find it a driving passion of mine right now. I work with my local synagogue, and I try to find places I can help make a difference. And it's changed my life, that I can do this, and I'm able to do this.
Wow. And are you happier now?
I feel a lot of ways. Yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, I've had some interpersonal issues. I'm actually divorced, but that actually was for the best. But and I have a son that grew up to be a wonderful man, and I adopted a dog last year. I never thought I'd have a dog again, but it's like 45 years since I had a dog, but there was a dog that needed a foster that almost died, and this rescue group saved the dog, and then I adopted this dog, and he's also changed my life. So between the dog and feeding the homeless.
Yeah, that could make quite a difference, suddenly a new pet. Yeah.
But I think so many people could give service, and they don't. I don't know. I just see so many people concerned about buying the next, new Gucci bag or the next car. And I wonder, if they realize how much they could do and how it might make them feel better. To me, service is something my parents instilled in me. They were very charitable. And I think it's something we all can do, and it's changed my life. And I like to think, that's my change of life for me. I don't have to have a big corporate job now making six figures, and I struggle. I mean, I'm considered low income right now, but I'm happy in a lot of ways.
There you go.
That's really something. It's interesting. That's a great story, Cindy. It's interesting that the research actually finds that as people, I don't know how old Cindy is, but as they get above 50, as they age, kind of a couple of things happen. One is that your brain actually gets happier. It's interesting. You begin focusing, your brain actually focuses more on the positive than the negative. And when you're younger, it tends to focus on the negative. So actually people naturally get happier. But also what they have noticed is that people begin to, and we talked about this before, but Cindy's talking about this now, people begin to focus on two things that are really important. They focus on people, like Cindy's son, and I'm sure she has lots of friends, and friends in the shelter that she's working in, not the shelter, but her organization, and they focus on causes. And what's really great about people and causes, as opposed to, worrying about whether you're going to be CEO or whether you're going to get a promotion or whether you'll get a raise or whatever, what's great about people and causes and focusing on those is that you can actually control that. Like, you can determine the tenor of your relationship with, Cindy can determine it with her friends and with her son. She can choose to invest in the homeless. These are choices that actually are under her control. And so happy midlifers actually focus on those things that are important to them, those things and people that are important to them. And happily, those are things that they can generally control.
Here's a good one. Pamela, emailer. So many seniors are now engaged in social media like Facebook. Is this good?
Well, that's a double-edged question in some ways. Now, social media can be really, really great, and it could be terrific for seniors if they're connecting with their children or their grandchildren or whatever. The danger, and if they're taking a page from the millennials, and the millennials use social media in the right way, which is they use social media to actually meet up and have face-to-face relationships, right, or friendships. They don't. But if you use social media as a substitute for real relationships, that can be very bad. That can actually create a sense of isolation and depression. So as long as seniors are actually using this to foster and help their relationships, as opposed to just putting all the best pictures up on Facebook and making everyone think that your life is perfect when actually it isn't, as long as you're fostering relationships, it's a great tool. And it's a great tool for people who may not be as able to get around as easily. So I am more power to them.
And next caller, Carrie in Boca Raton. Hey there.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Brilliant way to frame this issue around research. So often we hear people that just have an opinion about something. So grateful for that thought. Quick follow-up on the second phase of life and dealing with legacy planning, you know, not just to perhaps extend on things like Cindy, and thank you, Cindy, for not creating a 501c3. You have a wonderful community foundation, as most communities where they don't need to create those kinds of entities, but really thinking about your legacy. What is your legacy as end or begin into the second half, and think about that.
Right. I think that is, there we go right back to this idea of generativity. And we go back to this idea of investing in the next generation or investing in a cause that's really important to you. You know, I really feel badly when I see people who are still trying to, you know, of course you should be trying to climb the ladder when you're in your 30s and 40s. Because you've got a family, you know, you're trying to get your kids educated, get them through college. You know, you need these resources. But at some point, you don't need as much. You don't need as much stuff. And at that point, then the way to create a legacy, unless you're wealthy and you can, you know, start a foundation or something like that, the way to create a legacy is actually to invest yourself into other people and into other causes. I'm not saying that you quit your job and, you know, without, and you don't have any retirement savings or anything like that. But what I am saying is that you should begin to pivot and think more about other people, and this is what you're talking about, Carrie, and the legacy that you will leave, the imprint you will leave on this world. And it's not going to be because you got a promotion. It's going to be because you invested in your children or grandchildren or nieces or someone else.
I assume, thank you for your call, Carrie. We appreciate it. About if older people or midlifers would work more with young people, does that tend to make you feel a little younger?
Yeah. Yeah, that is
and also
a real,
appreciated by some of them,
that's,
too.
That's right. You know, it's funny because I think being in midlife, I've kind of had this idea, or, you know, I'm 56 now, so I'm smack in the middle of midlife. You have this idea, oh, well, young people don't really want to hear from me. I mean, you know, they're young and energetic and they look great in bathing suits and they're, you know, their synapses are firing really fast. So, but that turns out not to be true. Young people really want wisdom. The one thing that we can give them is a sense of experience and wisdom and perspective. So I find that young people, you know, I worked a lot with interns and I still work with young people. And what I can offer them is a sense of, you know, that may not be the end of the world. Okay, if you don't get this job, it's not the end of the world. Why don't you think about this? Right. Why don't you do X, Y, and Z? Or you need to navigate this personal relationship maybe in a slightly different way. Let me tell you what it looks like having, right, you know, 30 years on you. And so I think young people really want that.
Well, it's certainly been a very interesting hour. It's really flown by for me. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, thank you very much for joining us. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, of course, is a longtime NPR correspondent, and her new book is Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Thank you very much, Barb.
It was great to be here. Thank you, Joseph.
And thanks for joining us. Apologies to callers we couldn't get to, including Tessa and Tom. The program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. Of course, we have free audio archives for download at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos available at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, we go at your service with our pet care edition with veterinarian Dr. Ian Kupke and animal trainer and behaviorist Adele Mieres. One surprising topic, your animals may be subject to springtime allergies. The itchies. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.